If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained. I am your host, Brandon Pham. This is the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am here with my special guest this week, Ryan Sumo. How you doing, Ryan?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Sorry for the technical difficulties, but I'm glad to have you and finally getting to talk to you. This is actually part of the podcast where I actually ask the guests, which is yourself, about yourself to introduce to our listeners and viewers out there who you are, where you're from, and where you're heading.
Sure. So again, my name is Ryan Sumo. I'm from the Philippines. I've been in the industry for It's a little hard for me to think about how long it's been. I guess a little over 15 years, kind of on and off. So I started out as an artist for like mobile games before there was an app store, when the telco companies were still the ones releasing games, and then Nokia was like the big dog of the mobile phone industry. I just kind of bounced around from company to company here until I became a freelance artist around maybe like 10 years ago. I just kind of built up my freelance career from there. And like the biggest game I've worked on as a freelancer was called Prison Architect. And a lot of people, I think, have played the game. Last year, it was bought by Paradox Interactive. But I was just a contract artist for the company that made it. But after that came out in 2015, I decided that maybe it was time for me to run my own studio. Try to get my own games out there. And so a couple of my friends and I decided to open a studio, and we've released two games so far, a strategy game called Political Animals and a builder tycoon management sim called Academia School Simulator. And that's still in early access right now, and we're still working on that. But we're also working with another local studio here in the Philippines to publish their game called Gruin Arc, and that one's it's kind of a evil overlord simulator. But we can talk a little bit more about that later on.
Yeah, man. Whenever we have international guests, and I apologize again for staying up so late. So let's try to see if I can keep you awake. interesting conversations. What I would like to start off with is, what's the game scene like in the Philippines? Is it, especially with Asian culture, I feel like game development is still very new, especially trying to explain to older generations or parents. They don't get
sure,
it.
Sure.
And except maybe in China, I feel like other, or maybe Japan and maybe Korea. I'm from Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So I feel like in those lesser developed countries where the career is not really a well-known track. Has it changed in the recent years? Are you seeing a huge potential upswing in the next few years because of more global appeal?
Yeah. I think it's definitely different from when I was in college. I mean, there weren't really any companies. So maybe one or two companies were around, when I was in college, when I got out of college, so that's maybe 2003.
And you said you were born there. You're obviously still there. What kind of outside influence or outside interest have you been seeing with especially starting your own company now? Are there a lot of venture capitalists going through the Philippines for game development right now?
In that sense, I think we're still very very immature. I mean, I think even in broadly speaking, like in terms of like venture capital. So like I'm friends with a couple of tech bros. Very different landscape, right? Like the internet has changed everything, Steam has changed everything, the App Store has changed everything. So there's like all sorts of different marketplaces now where, you know, you can, you know, even just on your own, you can make a game, release it into the world, and, you know, kind of fingers crossed, you might get a flying bird or whatever. So yeah, there's a lot more companies now. I mean, there's a small industry, right? There's a proper industry here right now. There are a bunch of larger companies. Most of them do like outsourcing. But like, for example, Ubisoft recently opened a studio here, and like they're aggressively like ramping up, like even during the COVID like 19 crisis, like they still had like Facebook ads like saying that they were looking for people to staff up. And there's like small companies like ours who are putting up their own IP. There's a couple of us out there, and it's just gonna, you know, it's gonna keep growing as the industry in general keeps growing. Mm-hmm.
And you said you were born there. You're obviously still there. What kind of outside influence or outside interest have you been seeing with especially starting your own company now? Are there a lot of venture capitalists going through the Philippines for game development right now?
In that sense, I think we're still very very immature. I mean, I think even in broadly speaking, like in terms of like venture capital. So like I'm friends with a couple of tech bros. Like there's also a small tech industry here. Like fintech is kind of big here. Yeah, like it's not you know, there's always every like smaller country is always like trying to be like the next Silicon Valley of whatever region that they're in. But in terms of that, I think it's still very immature. And like in terms of like funding, let's say like I think you'd struggle to like say like get a loan from a bank or something and try to explain to them that you're trying to run a game studio. So like in terms of funding, I don't think it's very mature. Like you know, there are some like smaller like regional publishers which are providing funding like for studios and for games, and you know, like we're starting to notice like some people like asking questions about the Philippines, but yeah, I think we're it's probably one of the biggest issues for us is like access to, yeah, like access to funding for sure.
And you've been in the industry for a while now, just recently created your own studio. Congratulations on that, and shipped two games.
Thank you.
Right, which is a huge feat in whatever country you're from, because a lot of it has to do with like just determination, the upswings, downswings, and surviving through all that. What has been the hardships and the least expected things that have happened for you and your partner and your company that you did not foresee but overcame?
That's a pretty difficult question. I think, like I said, funding is a big problem. So for us, we were kind of like, before we started the company, even we all had, you know, we all had our regular day jobs, and we were just working on our game on the side. And I had the opportunity to go to this conference in London called EGX, because I was invited by Introversion Software, the creators of Prison Architect, to fly over to like celebrate the launch of the game. So while I was there, I had like a demo of our game, and I just I took advantage of the fact that there were publishers there, and so I just went to like publisher booths and presented a demo, and luckily someone picked up the game. In terms of like being in the Philippines, I think one of the probably the more difficult things for us is that there's not like a huge pool of talent here. Compared to like game dev meccas like San Francisco or maybe even like London or Japan, or like, you know, places that have an established industry and they're like established companies there, and like there are people like kind of always kind of learning the process of making games and then like moving to different companies and maybe like striking out on your own. There's not as big a pool of talent here. And so like a lot of companies, it's like the competition for talent is pretty hard. For us, I think though, like, what helped us out there was I used to be like the head of the local IGDA here, and I kind of before we started the company, I was also like a community organizer, like in terms of game developers, and I've kind of built up a network of people here, and so that really helped out. So I could ask like, hey, like who's interested in, you know, like making these kinds of games, and I was kind of plugged into like what was going on in terms of the industry. And so that definitely really helped out, like the fact that I was actively trying to build up the local game developer community, helped put me in access to, people who would be interested in making the kinds of games that we're making.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is, like you said, the pool of talent is definitely difficult to come by, and it is very restricted to your locale. With the recent events with COVID, I think there's a huge push for remote working and opening up a lot of those doors for our future of the game industry as a whole. And though I don't think 100% of us will fully convert to that format, because I think they're executives are racing back to the office as fast as possible. Yeah. But I think a good percentage, like average, will stay with some kind of hybrid approach. How do you see that kind of helping with the problem that you're seeing in the Philippines, where talent isn't as openly available? I know you guys are working your own games, but like also having companies being able to be external developers for assisting other companies in other countries now, opening up that network of communication. Do you see this being a huge impact to what you guys are doing?
I don't know. Like it's tough. Like we're actually, so we weren't super affected by like the current crisis because we're mostly working from home anyway. So like what we would do is we'd have like 2-week sprints, and so we would work for most of the week, and then we'd just meet up once a week to like have a face to face and discuss issues or whatever, and then like have pizza and board games. And right now, like we've transitioned pretty well to working like completely offline, completely online. Although like, I think like having maybe like a wider access to, I guess, like a wider pool of talent. So like even just within the region, like within Southeast Asia would be pretty interesting. It's still a little bit difficult. Like I'm still not sure like how that would really work for us, even just in terms of like contracts or like figuring out those kinds of things. And like one of the major issues for us is that like our internet is super, it's pretty bad. We spend like at least 15 minutes like during our bi-weekly meetings now, just like, you know, like checking, can you repeat that? You're kind of choppy, like so like the internet's really, really bad here. So that's kind of one of like the main issues keeping us maybe from doing that more, embracing like the work from home process more.
Yeah, online connectivity is huge if you're remote working, for sure. I know, I feel spoiled just talking about how my internet hiccups once in a while, but like in other countries, you know, you guys are facing real issues with that. That's why I think like, you know, with stuff that Elon is doing with the Starlinks that's going to beta and stuff is very promising, where it's not based on landlines anymore. And for connectivity, it's just, if you have a satellite pointed to the sky, you can have
high speed. That would be nice. Yeah.
So aside from that though, like you guys are pretty much used to this. I think the indie scene have a lot more training, and I always see them in that community with you guys are kind of like the pioneer of what game development actually will look like in a few years. And a lot of that has to do with working from home, communicating online, and the ability to not always have to be physically next to each other to get things done. And we're seeing that, at least across the industry, in a forceful way that we have to be able to operate like this to progress as an industry and open up opportunities. Were there a lot of trial and error to get to a point where you guys were efficient, aside from the internet problems? Where you kind of met up and hit a rhythm to finally get stuff done and not fall in the trap of meetings all the time?
I think one of I forget, there was a like there was an article going around a couple of months ago, like by the Basecamp guy, I think, like there's something about like levels of like working from home or something. So I think that one of the major issues for people who are used to like working in an office to working from home is just like kind of like forgetting about the idea of, you know, like just walking over to someone's table and like pointing at the screen and chatting about this or that or the other thing. So like there's a lot of like face-to-face communications and like body language communication that, you know, obviously can't happen as well online. Like even if you're on a video chat, like there's still a lot of stuff that it's just like we're able to express to each other, like when we're trying to explain things, when you're face to face in an office. And so like, I think like for me, like maybe the biggest, the linchpin of being able to work from home really well is like to have a good like producer or project manager, and like kind of having like very good like processes where like, okay, like this is how you should communicate, like when you assign a task, like you should have this, that, and the other thing, kind of streamline that process. So like there's less just like asking each other questions back and forth, like and it's they're kind of in the middle of building a game. You don't really have the time to really step back and look at like your communications processes. And so we kind of just try to improve on the fly. So like just really better communication and like having someone like keep an eye on the schedule and keep an eye on like how we communicate with each other so that we're not losing time by asking each other too many questions. I think that's a pretty big deal.
Let's talk about the two games process, right, that you guys went mm-hmm. through. So the first game obviously feels like usually would be the toughest to tackle. It's the first time working together with your team, first time setting everything up. There's a lot of like first times. Can you kind of talk about those challenges in developing your first game?
There's obviously so like my co-founders and I, we actually we'd never worked together before then, so that was kind of tricky, you know, like you're kind of getting to know each other and like kind of understanding your strengths and weaknesses, or even like it's like even like just understanding each other's like sleep schedules, because like so like one of my co-founders has like he has sleep apnea, and so like he has trouble. He can only like really sleep very well at certain times of the night, and so like he wakes up like pretty late. I wake up maybe usually around 9 o'clock, and let's say he's usually up around 1, and so just kind of figuring out a rhythm where. Yeah, 1 p.m. So like
that's huge.
And so like I keep having to we have to adjust to each other, and so like at the start, like I would feel there's like kind of guilt, like if like he gets up at 1 and then he's working until like whatever, like 11 or 12, and like there's sometimes like it feels like I'm being dragged along because like I don't want to leave him while he's still working. But then like you kind of get over that eventually, and you just have to like, you know, talk to each other and say, okay, look, I'm up at 9 and I'm kind of working already, so we can communicate with him like these windows of time. So let's make sure that we're talking to each other then. And then like when I'm out, I need to rest. And, you know, like I'm married, and like, you know, you kind of have to tend to your relationships. You can't just like work all night like you used to.
Yeah. I always compare it to, you know, you gotta, you know, as a man, right? Or for me, myself, got to tend to the first wife before the second wife. I always see a partnership as a marriage, because a lot of it is that. It's a lot of it's just finding each other's
work. Yeah.
And more than just riding the high times of success, it's the failures that actually test the relationship, like any relationship, right? Where it's like, can we really do this?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, worst case scenario. And yeah, the sleeping thing sounds pretty mundane and simple, but it is a huge factor because you only have so limited a time to actually talk to each other. I think people in the office see glimpses of that, where people show up early and then leave around 5, and people who show up late stays later and usually gets a better impression because they're later in the office, but we did the same 8 hours.
Right.
It's funny to kind of hear that on the indie side, which makes sense. It's like there's more accountability with lesser people, so you feel more guilty of anything if you're like disappearing.
Behind
a desk. So that was the biggest challenge. And of course, how long did you guys anticipate the first game coming out versus to your plan to it actually coming out?
I mean, like. There's a joke, right? Like if you plan for a year, just expect it to come out like a year and a half. So always add 50% more to whatever your estimate is. We like for our first game, I think it's hard to remember now, but I think we were planning on working on it for 9 months. But we definitely went a few months over. I think we got it out within a year. So it was a political strategy game, and we were hoping to get it out a little sometime during the US elections, because the idea was we can kind of market it that way. Unfortunately, we released it right at the last week of the US elections, and I think that's not really the best time to do it, because by that time people were kind of just sick of the elections, and so partly it didn't do very well. You kind of also learn that always give yourself a little leeway when it comes to development time, because even in the best case scenario, and the best case scenario almost never happens anyway, there's just gonna be something that pops up and bites you in the ass, like a bug or whatever, that really, really kind of sets back your schedule.
Hmm. And the first game that we're talking about is Political Animals, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Yep.
So that's a very unique theme. And it seems like both of your games kind of surround around education. Mm-hmm. Was this always a passion of yours and your teammates?
For us, I mean, at least so for Political Animals, it was definitely the idea was I'm interested in politics in general, the act of running for politics, winning elections. Partly because of the Philippine political system is, I don't want to go down to a rabbit hole, but it's sort of messed up.
It's pretty crazy.
The idea was the idea was kind of okay, this is what it's like, and there's no there's never going to be an easy way to keep your paws clean if you're going to politics. So the idea was this is a way for people to understand what it's like, and should they ever want to run, just to kind of mentally prepare yourself for what's going to happen. But we kind of made it so it's still approachable and kind of, you paid attention to having good game mechanics and different characters that you can hire and stuff like that. And so that even though Political Animals didn't do very well in terms of sales, it's had a bit of an interesting life in terms of local education, because one of my co-founders, former professors, he's really big in terms of studying game-based learning. And he was really interested in the game, and we've done actually a couple of workshops with him where he would ask high school students or teachers to split up into groups and to play the game against each other, and then they would have a discussion afterwards about how do you feel about the political process, and kind of using it as a means to discuss these larger ideas. And so that's been pretty nice to have. Even though it didn't sell very well, at least we feel it's useful to people.
Before we continue this week's episode, let's have a word from our sponsor. More and more companies are working remotely, but Parsec for Teams lets game makers break free from the studio and work from anywhere. You can use Parsec for professional and personal use to connect computers at 60 frames per second, ultra high definition video streams with super precise inputs for mouse handling and controller support. Working together is as simple as sharing a link with a teammate. You can then share files, review work, or even work together in a single program. It's the closest thing to being in the same studio. I actually used Parsec for running GDUX this year, and it was the greatest way for me to connect to my main computer and for my team to work with me to deliver the best virtual game dev conference. So I definitely see a huge use for remote working, but also playing games with each other. The biggest thing with remote desktop is that there are security concerns. However, Parsec for Teams ensures that only people on your team has access to your projects. Connections are peer-to-peer and encrypted, never touching the backend and features, two-factor authentication, and other security measures that gives you a peace of mind. So like mentioned before, the best use cases using Parsec for Teams is perfect for level design, animation, game development, playtesting, and more, and lets you seamlessly connect programs like Unity, Unreal, Maya, Cinema, 4D, and others. So hundreds of AAA and indie studios are already using Parsec for Teams to stay connected to their work. So go check it out at parsecgaming.com/teams. It seriously is one of the easiest and fastest and reliable remote desktop applications I've ever used. And it's perfect for gamers and game developers alike. So go check it out in the link description below. Now back to this week's episode.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say, it seems like this type of game would work the best in educational system. Like for me, I don't understand politics at all, and I don't even pretend. Mm-hmm. But I would love to be interested. I am interested enough to know, or at least want to know how it works. And a lot of it, again, is not very approachable textbooks on it. And I think the subject that you're taking on feels like such a original space that not a lot of people try to tackle, that it mm-hmm. feels like you guys will have a lot of success in the educational system just running it through. Because my first exposure to game wasn't really that sexy. It was Oregon Trail, right? Inside a classroom.
Yeah.
And it was fun and I loved it. Or those math type of games. And I think a lot of people kind of dismiss that. I feel like there has been a resurgence in the educational game for learning type of space. Yeah. But when we talk about game development, we don't really think about that space as much. But I feel like it's just even more important than, you know, Last of Us 2.
Yeah. I played those games too. Like, I love the Carmen Sandiego games and the Oregon Trail. We actually looked into this a little bit because I was trying to see if that's an alternative revenue stream for us, right? Like educational games. But it's really difficult is what I found out. When you're selling like games on Steam or on the App Store, you're selling directly to the consumers, and that's difficult in and of itself, but there's no gatekeepers basically. Like you put it up on Steam, and if people like it, they'll buy it and you make some money. Whereas if I remember correctly, I forget the details, but at least in terms of the US, it's not the consumer that's going to buy your game and integrate it into the system, right? It's the local school board or the state Department of Education or something. And so there's a lot of different hoops that you kind of have to jump through, and a lot of people that you kind of know. I don't even know where you'd begin. Maybe you need to hire a lobbyist to approach local school boards and pitch the game to them or something. So that's a very interesting market, educational games, but it's very I think it's sort of impenetrable unless you really have those kinds of relationships at the local school level.
And I think that's what always interests me about the indie community, is that it's very self-driven, and a lot of the lessons that you learn are kind of lifelong lessons that you carry for future projects. It's just something that you don't learn. I come from the AAA space for most of my career. Mm-hmm. And in the span of the podcast, I've learned more about the industry than I've been in sitting at my desk just working on these games that I've always wanted to work on. And a lot of that a lot of what I've learned on the podcast and from you guys carries a lot more weight because of that. Because now that I'm I feel like I'm building up my RPG character to kind of take on the world. So like a lot of the, you know, when you're developing game, you don't, unless you're like a super visionary person, you have a faint idea that actually to the very end becomes what you see in your head. But a lot of times, a lot of self-discovery and navigating and kind of getting a feel for what the game is and what it's trying to tell you. I feel like marketing is another phase of that as well. It's like, well, now the game is out. Like, where's the audience? What's the audience? And you go down this path of unconventional ways. Like, I'm talking to the school board now. I'm talking to lobbyists.
Right, right.
It's like, what a weird way to market games, but it's super viable because if anything, that's actually probably where all the money's at, where it's like stable income, you know? So I'm always interested to kind of hear like this other side of game development. Which political animals totally see it. It's like, it looks awesome. It's actually a subject that I've always been interested in, but never really found approachable unless I'm going through Wikipedia and actually looking through. It's just not so inviting for me to kind of want to learn it through that way. But it's also cool to kind of hear that you guys already are navigating through that path because it feels very validating to kind of see that kind of effort on that side. So that, you know, after talking about the first game and you guys doing what most, I feel I call it the graveyards of indie developers. They never get past their first game or maybe shortly after you guys had enough to go on to working on the second game. So can you talk about that path? Was it more like, something that you had in the back pocket of what you wanted to do with the second game?
No, we launched Political Animals November 2016, and it was a flop. And it's sort of like the stages of depression thing, but like the first stage is like, okay, like maybe we still have a chance. Let's put out an update. Let's see what happens. Everyone, like as almost any game developer that's been through this will tell you, there's, if your launch is bad, there's like almost a 0% chance that, like somehow it'll rise again. And, I mean, that's just the way, for better or for worse, that's just kind of the way that the Steam algorithm works. It's like, if you don't launch well, it just assumes that people won't like your game, so like it won't show it to the players anymore. We had a month where we were trying to figure out like, okay, like can we still salvage this? And then in December of that year, we're like, yeah, okay, this is not it's not gonna work. So we need to like pivot into like something else. We have a little bit of money left. We slashed our salaries and we did like a brainstorming meeting. So like, okay, like it was very, very much like, what do we think has the best chance of making us money and like keeping us alive? And so like the internal pitch was like, Prison Architect was famous, so like a pretty it made quite a bit of money, and not everyone's been to prison, but everyone's been to school mostly. So we figured like that, you know, like having a builder or like management game with the school theme seemed to us like a pretty good, it had a good chance at least of making us enough money to keep us afloat. And so for most of early 2017, we were just working on a prototype. Within 3 months, we had like a very, very basic prototype that we could share. And like I started sharing it on YouTube, and people were signed to respond to it. And like every month we would build it up a little more and then share it on YouTube. And then we realized, okay, so there's a little bit of momentum behind this. And anyway, we didn't really have much of a choice, right? Like that's we already started it, so we just needed to keep on going until our money ran out. And so on September of 2017, we launched it on early access, and yeah, like it did, you know, it didn't like sell like gangbusters, but it sold enough so that like we could continue operating for a year. And so that was a huge load off of our shoulders. And yeah, like with every update of the game, it's just you know, it's been getting better and better. And people, like up to this day, people are still buying it, although sales are starting to like kind of slow down as we enter like our third year of development. So we started in 2017. This is 2020 now. So like, this is like, yeah, basically, we're entering, our fourth year of development now. And, we're starting to wind down actually to a version one release, this year.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in what I like about Steam Spy. It actually helps kind of gather all this data and kind of see in an average how games do in their lifetimes. I don't know if you're a math guy, or you look like it's, you know, like looking at stats and what it tells you, or how yeah. I'm just gonna assume we're Asian, that we kind of, I am sort of interested in that a bit, right? That do you see a pattern there, where is there anywhere in the lifetime? I know you guys are in third year, about your fourth, where you know the upticks are probably the Steam sales, but like have you seen surprising things that you guys done and then are able to see the output of it pretty immediately, and were you guys able to repeat that? Can you tell more about that side of marketing, or like after a game launch, how much impact you have?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, most of the peaks I've, I actually did a couple of articles about this, like on Gamma Sutra. And I mean, I can share them with you later, so like you can share it to your community. Mm-hmm. But like basically the peaks really center around like the Steam sales. There were a couple that were generated by like really, big streamers like this guy Jacksepticeye, DanTDM. So we got a couple of YouTubers where like so they made a video of the game and they had like 2 million views or whatever, and so that generated a lot of peaks. But like I will say that like the I forget the exact conversion rate, but it was like views to dollars is like, I don't know, like one view is like 0.00082 cents or something like that. I forget, like, but it's a ridiculously small conversion rate, but like it did generate peaks for us. Like you kind of have like when you're selling within Steam, like which would. You sort of just have to work within like the confines of their ecosystem. So like you know, they have a couple of ways that they use to share the game to their players. So you kind of just have to take advantage of those things and try to use all of the ways which Steam encourages you to share your game, so that you have a better chance of being seen.
Mm-hmm. And this is a constant curiosity of mine, because we've had many guests on where I think the amateur onlooker for what constitutes into an actual game sale views streamers or YouTubers as a gateway to success. But a lot of the reality is that, you know, people just watch it for the personality and maybe thirdly about the game. Oh, as sell through, even though it is somewhat of a viable, if you get a lot of them going, but what has been the most effective way that you've seen in terms of conversion to sales? If you can share a little bit of that,
I mean, honestly, like outside of Steam, there's really nothing that that I've seen. Like, so outside of like, you know, like YouTube streams, there's really nothing that has had a significant impact on our sales in any meaningful way. Like, you know, we've had a couple of like press outlets write about us. I forget who specifically, but a couple of big like press outlets wrote about us when we launched, and there wasn't really a lot of impact from that. Really, like, it's just like within Steam, like, how do you can, like, you can, because you can sometimes like make your own sales, and they have this thing called like visibility updates. And so you like, well, my advice has always been like, you know, you kind of try to stack those. So like, you do a sale, and then you do an update to your game, and then you do like a visibility update, and like, you like kind of you know, you combine those things and you stack them up, and hopefully that generates enough interest. And then maybe someone at Steam will notice the game and say, hey, like, or like, you know, they have like internal metrics, I think, at Steam that like tell them like, you know, like what our X game is doing pretty well, like, let's offer them a daily deal. And that's something that's happened to us like twice so far, where we were generating enough interest where Steam just automatically gave us like a deal. And like, once you're on like the front page of Steam, that's definitely a big deal. Although, like, on the flip side, should say that like Political Animals, actually, we were able to, because we had a publisher that had worked in Steam before, we were able to swing like front page on Steam for Political Animals, and that still didn't save us. So So that's just something to keep in mind, that like, it's really kind of crazy. One thing that like might be of interest, sort of a off topic, but even within like YouTube streamers, there's like different conversion rates, I guess, like depending on, a lot of it depends on like, I think like the basically the country of origin. So like, you know, like UK or American streamers, like, fairly, comparatively speaking, pretty good conversion rates. But like, we had like one time there was a pretty big like Mexican games. I think he's Mexican, definitely like Latin, and like, so he had like 2 million plus views. But like, compared to the other streamers, there wasn't a lot of like uptick in like South America or like Mexico in terms of game sales. And that might have to do with demographics, like how many people are on Steam in South America. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting, that like you can have the same number of views, but like maybe different people are watching those streams, like, who like, it was funny, like after we had that stream, like the Latin American streamer, like, we had a bunch of people like emailing us in Spanish, like asking like, where do they find the game, like, how do you buy the game? And so like, which gives me an inkling that like, you know, like maybe Steam hasn't really penetrated that far into those markets. And so like, there's no like that consumer habit of like, oh, I see this game like being played by my streamer, and then I'll check this game out on Steam.
Yeah, it's a constant reminder how powerful, or how I wouldn't say monopoly anymore, but sort of monopoly that Steam
still,
has.
Still pretty close.
Yeah. And it does make sense. Like, people who are in the Steam storefront are more likely wanting to buy things because they're in the store, right? We just go back to physical stores, you know. So the reach and the likability of them purchase something is huge. Of course, with Epic Game Store, they're only going for like certain games for now. I mean, maybe years down the line they'll open it up more and more, which I don't doubt they're not gonna do that. So we're just waiting a few more years for those guys kind of be a likely competitor, which helps indie developers can shine more, right?
Yeah,
because right now, Steam is It's a tough thing. Like I always feel like they can do more at Valve.
Yeah.
But then I'm always reminded, like, there's only like 200 people over there or something like that. They have such a small group of developers.
You'd think so they could hire some more people, right?
I know, right? But the profit margin's too good, I guess. Gabe loves that. But I don't know. It feels like the lion has woken over there. Because since Epic, they're making games again, Half-Life Alyx, VR centric, they're announcing three more, like that. They're suddenly doing things again. Valorant, kind of like stealing Counter-Strike's thunder a little. So, I like where Valve is doing. I do not like what they were doing like for 4 years or 5 years plus, like, which is pretty much nothing. I always felt that they would be the champion for the little guys, but they haven't been that way with their storefront. Maybe they're just tired.
As much as I complain, you know, I'm like every other developer on Steam. I like to whine a lot. The honest truth is that, like, if there was no Steam, we wouldn't exist. Right. There's no marketplace. Like, it gives us here like access to the world, basically. Like, right, we can just put our game there and like we can sell to the entire world, which is a huge deal. Like 10 years ago we wouldn't exist. Like there's one local indie studio that was alive in like 2005 or something, and like the lengths that they had to go through to like, you know, like make their game and then find a publisher, like find someone who was like able to, like willing to spend the money to like print their game on like on CDs and print out the boxes and then like ship it to like stores and stuff. Like it's kind of insane, like how complicated retail games were just like 10 or 15 years ago. So, you know, like for all the Steam deservedly like takes a lot of flack, there's no question in my mind that like we wouldn't have our studio, we wouldn't be able to make games and sell it like to the world if it wasn't for Steam. Like, or maybe Epic would have stepped up. Like in an alternate universe, Epic would have been the storefront to the world.
Mm-hmm. Being number one is definitely a tough job for anybody, so it's very understandable that they're getting a lot of criticism as well as praise at the same time. So with that being said, I know you guys are Steam focused, but I would love to kind of hear your thoughts more. I don't know if you're connected with people who have published games on the PlayStation front, the Xbox front, the Switch front. Did you guys yourself look at this as alternatives? I think the last time those consoles made a splash within the development was the originator, which is Xbox Game. What was it called? Xbox.
Xbox Live Arcade. I don't know.
Yeah, Arcade Live Arcade. Yeah, like that. Mm-hmm. They started it and they just let it die. And I haven't heard too much of a splash from those guys. I mean, Switch was the closest where I feel like there was a resurgence of indie games going over there, but. Mm-hmm. What's your general feeling about that space? Is that viable? Is that
something? The short answer is it's not really viable for us. Simply because like they refuse to sell us dev kits. I've actually asked like reps from Microsoft, and you know their answer is like, yeah, we don't sell dev kits there, but you know, if you know a guy, or like, you know, there's like gray areas where you can figure out a dev kit. So it's like really you know, it's a little like disheartening, like, you know, like if you're not there, then I don't know, like why would we bother? And and you know, console is a little bit more. I don't actually have enough knowledge of the console space, but like what I understand is like, you know, like there's a lot more like certification processes, like before they even let you put the game on, like on the store. Whereas like, you know, like on VC, it's more like kind of a Wild West. Like, you know, we're in early access, so like we're putting out stuff, and like within minutes we get like bug reports or like the game not loading. So, you know, we have to scramble to put up a hot fix. And that's the kind of stuff that doesn't really happen in terms of console. So like the short answer is it's not really viable for us, at least as a gateway to game development. But we are, so for academia right now, we're actually looking for for console publishers that would be interested in taking academia and then figuring out the porting process, like how do you map the controls to a controller versus mouse and keyboard, and then release it worldwide on all three of the consoles. So I don't have any direct experience with it yet, so I can't really do any comparisons, but I'm definitely interested to see how it goes.
All right, last question, I promise. So the publishing side of things, right? So indie developers are faced with choices where they gung-ho it by themselves the whole way, or they tag team a friend or a partner that have done this many times and just take that off your plate so you can focus on the game. Yeah. Did you guys try all routes before going with the publisher, or you just looked out and you found a great publisher, obviously, and decided to go that way?
For me, like I said earlier, like the biggest problem was really funding, right? So for our first game, I definitely didn't want to like mortgage like our apartment. I didn't want to like put my savings on my like meager savings on the line at that time. For our first game, for Political Animals, there's just no way I was gonna do it like with my own money. I'm not you'd think I'd be more of a risk taker because like I'm a quote unquote entrepreneur, but like I'm very I'm actually very risk averse. Like it's you kind of tweak it as you go. Obviously you can't like be in any kind of business if you're not willing to take any risks, but like on the scale of entrepreneurs, I'm very I'm pretty risk averse. And so for our first game, we definitely it was like publisher or nothing at all. Luckily we found a publisher. And really lucky for us because it didn't do well, so we didn't lose any money, and I feel bad for our publisher, but you know, like they knew that risk going in, and they did their due diligence, and it just doesn't pan out sometimes. So for our second game, we had a better idea, I think, of what we wanted to do. And we wanted to just kind of, you know, do it on our own. But also it was just like things were just moving too fast for us to like really stop and pitch it to a publisher. And also like we, you know, by releasing early, like by releasing our progress early and seeing that there was interest, you know, we had some inkling that, the game might do well. But I think honestly, like we were sort of at the point where it's like, you know what, if this does well, then great. We keep going. If it doesn't, maybe it's time to, pack it up and, start looking for jobs again. Just turned out that we got lucky the second time around, and, so it's, we've done pretty well. We did take a little bit of investment money, just for the game. And so like kind of just to help us get to the finish line in terms of, when we release for early access. But otherwise, we're self-published, and, I feel like, again, like this is nothing with Steam, like we have to be thankful. Like they've just made it really easy for almost anyone to self-publish their own game and like kind of make a living off of it. And Yeah, and now so we did well enough actually that we had a little bit of money like put aside, and I found another local studio that was working on a really cool game, and like I started chatting with them. It's like, hey, like, you know, I think your game's really cool, and like at the start I was more like, if you guys want a publisher, like I'll hook you up with like some people I know, because like I really, really just want, like, I was just very excited to see another studio locally working on a game that I thought was cool. And so like I was just like, yeah, I want to help you guys succeed, like, regardless. Yeah, like we kind of got to talking, and I said, like, you know, we could help you out with the funding, if you're interested. And we just, you know, we kept up that communication, and so now we're both a developer and sort of like quasi publisher. Like we, yeah, like I mentioned earlier, we're publishing a game right now, that's called Ruin Arc. It's like an evil overlord simulator. You're basically a demon, and you're wreaking havoc on a village of people, like throwing down meteors and poison and all sorts of stuff. I don't know if the Steam Festival is still ongoing right now, but like there's a demo out on Steam if anyone wants to go and try it out.
Sweet, we'll definitely link that for sure. And I thank you, man, for paying it forward. I think that's one of the biggest, coolest things about game developers. We're always very wanting to help and pass on the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like the people who give more actually receive more. In the end, it's just, you know, you build a community and trust, and you actually build this huge network. And I always say to indie developers, it's always like, if you make it to the third game, that's when it really goes crazy. It seems like the average is like, you get to the third game, you go through all those trials and errors, and you hit your rhythm. Yeah. You finally know what you're doing, and you're like understanding this landscape. I'm very thankful and looking forward to the game that you guys are publishing and the games that you guys are working, man, because that's a huge deal. That's a huge accomplishment. You're in the 1% tile for most indie developers already.
Yeah, I wonder actually if we should have just kept the money, but we've already struck the deal. So anyway,
yeah, man,
I hope it does enough. Well, I hope I made the right decision.
we'll definitely link it if it's in the Steam Festival. That's a huge one. They only selected a few good ones to showcase there, so it's already on the right track. We're at the hour, and again, thank you for sticking with us for the hour. I know we were trying to cut it short, but you know, it was just so interesting. So I lost track.
Yeah, that's cool.
This is my time to actually throw the mic over to you to give a shout out, attention to, or talk about any issues that you want to talk about to our listeners and viewers out there.
Yeah. So like definitely please do check out Ruin Arc on Steam. We have a demo out right now, and like the developers would really like to know what you think. And please do check out, like, try to check out games from like the Southeast Asian region and like the Philippines. I'm not very good at this. I'm not good at like marketing, like other stuff. But check out like on Google, like on Rising Sea. I forget. I'm super not prepared. But like, so there was like a game jam recently where it was like a bunch of Southeast Asian game developers got together. And they just released their games recently, and a bunch of them are pretty cool. So if you check out Rising Sea, if you like search for Rising Sea games, a game Rising Sea Game Jam on Google, pretty sure you'll be able to find that. Check out Academia School Simulator if you're into like chill builder like tycoon games. We just released an update recently, and we're just churning out those updates like every like month and a half. That's just top of mind right now. Um and uh yeah I'm sorry. I'm kind of fading. I know.
It came off right. So I understood what you're saying. So, all right. One last thing before we go, though. Can you spell the name of that game, Ruin Arc? How do you say
it? Ruin Arc. So it's like ruin, like you're ruining something, and monarch. So like Ruin Arc.
I see. All right. Well, we'll definitely link. Mm-hmm. And in this video, I'll splice all the video footage so that people out there don't have to click around. But I want to thank you, Ryan, for coming on. And man, let's stay in touch, dude. I definitely want to make sure that, you know, you represent over there in the Philippines. I think it's Asia. We need development studios for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Sure.
All right, man. Thank you, man. Have a good one.
Thank you very much for having me. All right.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are liking the podcast, go to the Apple iTunes store and give GameDev Unchained a 5-star rating. This will help spread the joy and love and exposure for the podcast, and we thank you very much. If you want to continue the conversation, go to our Discord, which can be found on our website, www.gamedevunchained.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BlueChamps, BlueChamps. You want to catch these episodes live every Tuesdays and Thursdays, go to twitch.tv/blue_champs. Email me any of your concerns or questions that you want me to read aloud at the beginning of each episode at info@gamedevunchained.com. And if you want to further support us and help unlock the next feature, which is the voicemail feature, go to patreon.com/BlueChamps. This gives listeners a chance to kind of call in, leave a message for both me and the guests to answer your deepest, darkest questions and comment on your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you, everybody.